Hello, welcome to another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Jeff, how are you today?
I'm wonderful. How are you doing, Sal?
I'm doing outstanding.
Who's our guest today?
A returning guest.
Returning.
A crowd favorite.
Famous.
Yep. He's got groupies.
Baby, at home, I do not have groupies.
Well, we got that out of the way.
She knows.
Yeah.
She knows.
She does know.
We got Aaron Bledsoe. And before we get started, Aaron, you know what comes. It's the question of the day. And this is a fun question. This is just for you. So you got to pack your gun case, your bug out bag for the zombie apocalypse. What all do you throw in there?
I'm going to be honest. I hate the idea of like scary movies and zombies. We just had this talk.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just not big on it. But like, okay, so we got to quantify this or, you know, put some stipulations. Are we talking like Shaun of the Dead type zombies, like where they're just like, are we talking like Dawn of the Dead, like where they're full blown, like running around at high speeds and climbing stuff?
First guy that didn't like zombie movies, you know a lot about them.
Well, I was gonna thought the same thing.
I've been scarred. Okay. I've been scarred.
You're a sensitive type. Huh?
I am.
How about the Zombieland?
The Zombieland. Okay.
That's the one with Woody Harrelson.
I'm not.
They're kind of the...
Oh, okay, perfect. All right.
Yeah, not the fast movers.
All right.
Those are too creepy. Okay. Creepy enough, the first ones.
All right. So if I'm doing that, if I'm doing the slow ones, then I guess Bible, some food, handguns, because they're not real moving very quickly. So I'm not a very good handgun shot, but if... I mean, if they're slow, yeah. I can walk up to them and kind of double tap them and be done with it. But
I bet this one gets flagged.
Yeah. I was thinking about that on the left. Yeah. Maybe I should re-answer that one. All right. Bible.
Those were love taps, right?
Yeah. Love taps.
Those are Bible. We found out how to get flagged in our podcast.
We're done before we ever got started.
Well, let's see if I can make this worse then. All right.
And so, you were just getting ready to tell us about $6 corn, but got flagged.
Yeah. So Bible, food, a baseball bat.
Oh, you know, close
yeah,
in.
Yeah, close. Yeah. Just, you know, do my little thing. So I guess I'll swap out the pistols for a baseball bat, take a gun. That way I can hunt still. I mean, I'm assuming the normal world is done if we're in a zombie apocalypse. I don't know. Pretty boring. Anything that I can help my wife and daughter with,
there
I
you
guess.
Go.
Yeah.
All right.
Not a great answer.
That's pretty good. Yeah.
I don't know about this one. So
you can beat Aaron's Sunday school answer.
I guess
the Bible.
I,
hey, you know what?
How do you top that? Right.
I'll just pack all the extra ammo I can. How's that?
There you go. Yeah, we can go together. I mean,
there we go. Yeah, we live close. So yeah,
live close. You got a herd of family. So
you do have a big. You got a whole platoon.
I do.
Yeah.
Nobody ever said I have too much ammo.
That's right.
No.
Yep.
It doesn't go bad, as far as I know.
Well, I've got a goose gun, a Benelli. It's one of the pump actions. What do they call those? It's a
combustion shotgun.
Benelli brand. I forget the.
Is that the Nova?
Yes. Yeah, I got a Nova. Shoots 3.5 for, but I got a tube extension. It's got a 24-inch barrel with a tube extension all the way past the end.
Oh yeah, like a snow goose gun.
Yes, yeah. That's exactly why I got it. And my wife was way impressed. She goes, "Nothing you have in that."
For all the conservation officers out there right now, they wonder if that thing's plugged.
Your mind went there, and my mind went to that TikTok or YouTube video of that little girl going, "Look at all those chickens." Did you not see that? Oh my gosh, there's these, I can't remember if they're ducks or geese. I think they're geese, but I think they're all farm raised geese. They're just everywhere. And she points at them. I mean, I'm talking, I don't know, 4 or 5 year old kid at most. And she goes, "Look at all them chickens."
We're going to have to find. Well, that everybody clicked off of our app. Now they're onto this chicken app. They're looking on YouTube.
That's my bad.
They stopped.
Hey, would you use that voice for the rest of the podcast, please?
And that is why I don't have groupies.
God. All right.
What are we talking about today?
Oh, grain. Go.
Yeah. I guess what would you like to know?
Our zombie hunting grain guy.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. Go back to the zombie thing. I did, you know, back when Whitaker's was still in business down in Kentucky. Hey,
I tell you what.
Love Whitaker's.
Yeah. There was a pump action sawed off hand, it was a shortened stock zombie shotgun. But the pump had like this piece that went from the forend up on top. So you kind of held it kind of like a chainsaw type deal and you shucked it like that above.
Huh. I'm like with a handle on top?
Yeah. It was wild. I never would buy one, but it was cool to see. I mean, I guess there are preppers out there that want to be ready.
Tube or to have a drum on it or something?
I can't remember. I thought it had a drum on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was wild. Anyway, yeah, grain.
Hey, those zombies aren't going to kill themselves.
No. And hey, you know what? I'm in the right business for a zombie apocalypse. I've got plenty of grain. So
that is true.
That is, yeah. So, one of the cool things for this year was, we've alluded to the different projects we've had going on at Premier. Columbus and the Ligoti facility both added a little over 500,000 bushels of storage at each one.
Wow.
So it was kind of weird. I don't think either one of us said, you know what, let's add 560,000 bushels of storage at each facility. But somehow we both did the exact same amount. So it looks a little different as far as how we got to that number. But Jason up there at Columbus, I know they added in or revamped their second pit back there to increase the speed at which people get unloaded up there. So he's got two fully functioning pits that are running pretty quick. At the Ligoti, the only thing we did, I say only, was we added storage. So both facilities are full blown up and running now. We've got additional storage. He's at just around 2 million bushels and I'm at 1.7, just under 1.7. Both have drying capabilities, so we're still running strong.
I tell you, Aaron, and for the growers out there that are, within the southern Indiana and drive distance, but just the speed, I mean, that is worth so much to one, let you know it's coming, and then two, just getting unloaded and back and to turn those trucks. And that's one of the things I think is neat that you all have invested in, just the speed to get it done. And I can't imagine. I know there's good social time, but sitting in the grain line in trucks is probably not the best time to well spent,
So. Yeah, we don't mind it. I mean, we don't love it when it's raining out at the pit, but that's the time to be social. But whenever it's good running weather, guys don't use, they're not usually as social then. They're just in and out. And we do. We're very fortunate with what we have and how fast we can pump them out. I mean, we've heard multiple times, especially this year, which is kind of odd given how the year played out. But everybody that shows up, they're just like, man, it's just nice.
It is.
We just show up, we get unloaded, and we're out of here. Like, and everybody's pleasant. I mean, and with the apps and the way that we can do ACH grain payment now, I mean, it's just everything's nice. It just flows nicely. Whereas some other locations, it's not that they're worse than we are or any better than we are. It's just there's something nice about our facilities. We just pump them through quickly.
Well, I think the speed, and since I sit in the same office with you, I get to see the trucks turning in and out of there. And, that took a lot of planning and took a lot of investment on your part to put that kind of facility together. Mm-hmm. And so I think that does speak well for the place that you built there to service our customers. We always talk about the speed. I have jokingly said in the past, the people delivering to Ligoti, especially, they don't have a chance to even become world champion solitaire players in line because they don't have time to play solitaire. They got to keep pulling up. But I did look out my office window one day and I saw like four semis backed up. I've never seen that. And I came out and said, why do we have a line? Well, one pit had just gone down. It wasn't down very long. And it's like, oh, well, it's such and such pit just went down. So we're only working on one. Like 15 minutes later, the pit's back going and the line is gone.
Gone. Yeah.
So it was, so I guess I say that to say that you know, it's pretty cool to see when, if I see four trucks in line, something's wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they got it fixed and boom, the line was gone. So
yeah, that's one of the biggest questions. And Jason, you know, his area up in Columbus is slightly different of just how they kind of come in, and every location's different, but it's somehow everybody always kind of jumbles up together. You know, right out of the gate, when you open up, you usually have several trucks backed up. But then throughout the day, they kind of spread themselves out. And then late afternoon, they start bottlenecking back in. But the amount of times people are just like, they call in, they're like, what's your line? Like, I don't know how to answer your question. There is no line.
We don't like that. We run off. We unload them and get them out of here.
Yeah. They're like, well, what's your wait time? I'm like, we don't have I guess as long as it takes for you to tell us who this is for on the scale, that's the wait time. Because outside of that, you're pulling on, pulling off, and you're gone. So, yeah, we are fortunate. You know, between White River and Premier, and that, just the years that we've been doing it, and Jason, the foundation he built prior to Premier, a lot of money has been invested in just trying to help out the local farmer.
We all take so much pride, and not that everybody else doesn't, but. You know, we had our CEO in here talking about just what it's like to be a Premier Ag, and you do feel like you're working for someone and for something. And but it's obvious the pride you all take in your facilities and definitely just that the speed of unloading. I mean, that is you pride yourselves on that. Mm-hmm. And it is neat because I'm the same way when I'm there, and I don't office there every day, but when I am, it's just. I'm like, he was just in here. I mean, we're, you know, right? Yeah. Now they're gone.
He's
again.
Coming around.
Yeah.
He's already unloaded. He's going way out. So.
Yep.
What's the outlook? I think the November report, anything?
Yeah. So we're post the November report. That one had a couple surprises, really. You know, the average trade estimate thought that they would lower the corn yield or there was a wide range of guesses on that one, but that one kind of shocked us in the size of a shrink. You know, we're still talking, let's not paint this as a big rosy picture right now, because we're still talking a monstrous yield. I mean, we're record-breaking yield again, but they did lower it 0.75 bushel down to 183.1 instead of, 183.8. So,
which is amazing.
I mean, given the year that we had now, I know there's parts of the U.S. that is dragging that yield down, and there's other parts. That early stuff was phenomenal. I mean, phenomenal. I mean, if you got into that first planting window, heard a lot of best farm average ever, period. I mean, blew away last year, which is hard to believe. Last year was hard to believe, and then this year we backed it up again.
You know, Aaron, I hate to stop you there, but just we saw yields this year, and what was tough at times, and dryland corn, non-irrigated, in the 300s, which even though we may not have the most rosy picture as far as the prices, with the amount of grain that we're bringing in, that's not all bad.
No, it's not. So they lowered the yield. So that helped in that sense that it lowered the supply. They did not touch the beginning stocks, so there's really no disappearance there or anything like that of the old stocks rolling in. So they lowered it 61 million just because of the yield hit, left the acreage alone, didn't mess with the use. So that is a plus, okay? So it was nice to see them hold the usage because, personally speaking, I'm a little nervous of with the world and the supply that we have globally. If we don't start to see some chinks in the armor of the corn demand, that is what you don't want to see. Okay. When you have ample supply, you cannot take a hit on the demand side. Cause if you do, then it is a bloodbath in the futures market. So right now, because of the yield taking a little bit of a hit, we've at least stopped the bleeding. Okay. So the demand's holding strong. So that was great to see. Total wise, you know, with the drop in the yield and no other changes, 61 million loss in the ending stocks, still talking about a 12.9% stocks to use rate. So as far as perspective wise, where does that put us? Because everyone's like trying to look at past history to see where futures could go. And past doesn't always predict future, but it does give us some idea of what could potentially happen. You know, in a 12.9% stocks to use rate, you're talking like that 14, 15 or 15, 16 type stock to use rate for the U.S. If we keep building, that's the scary part is, you know, coming out of 12, we had very tight stocks. 13, we started to build. 14, we built. 15, we built. 16, we built. 17, 18, we had a little bit of a drawback, but then we bumped it right back up in 18, 19. If we are kind of in the same trend in the sense that we had 21, they were lower. 22, we started to ramp that stock, that ending stocks portion up. 23 did the same thing. Now we're going into another year where we've bumped that stocks to use rate up even higher. So right now the trend is ample supplies. So that's not a great picture.
In steady demand.
Steady demand. If we take any chink in the armor of demand, this could get more ugly than it already is.
On the other side.
Yep.
If there was an event of some kind that would spike demand, although nobody sees it.
Mm-hmm.
Short-term demand doesn't look like there's anything coming, but China did surprise us a few years back and came mm-hmm. in and bought some corn.
They did, yeah. And that's really what kind of drove the prices up then was, so if you look at total corn usage, exports play a part, but that's not the lion's share. You know, we use a lot of corn domestically, whether that's ethanol for the livestock, you know, like secondary products, like, I mean, just all the different things that we can do with corn in the ethanol process or the grinding process, we use a lot of it here. So anytime you see exports take a jump, that's a big deal. And that's what we saw a couple of years ago. And that was all piggybacking off of the fact that global corn supplies were a little tight because South America was having a little bit of a harder time. They didn't have a horrible crop, but it wasn't their normal crop. And right now, so how does this picture look different? Well, now Brazil can just flat out ship corn to China. That's different than what it was several years ago. So now we have another competitor in the marketplace for a direct ship to China. Before, if China wanted to buy that stuff, then it kind of had to go through some different channels and things like that. You know, there was still the competition in the sense that people bought Brazil, people bought different countries, bought U.S. Products. Okay. So now the U.S. and Brazil are directly competing for one location, and that's China.
Hmm.
So again, domestically, we use a lot of the corn, but if we can increase that export number, it helps. Mexico is our number one user. So as long as we can keep that relationship good or build upon it, that was the big scare in the past was when they came out with the non-GMO, we're not going to import GMO corn. We're going to try to, they're trying to ramp up their own domestic production. They're trying to essentially safeguard themselves from other supply issues around the world. And I can't blame them for that. The science behind the whole non-GMO stuff, I don't agree with, and that's not something we have to get into today, but what they were doing didn't make a whole lot of sense. So the market was waiting to see how that played out. Right now, they're still buying from us. So if we can improve that relationship, that'll be good. Ethanol. I think that's been a couple years, maybe 2 years ago. I don't know how long it's been since I've been doing this. But
2 years.
I came in here and I said, watch for the oil. That'll be the canary in the coal mine. Okay. When oil prices take a hit or the U.S. dollar gets stronger, you know, if oil takes a hit and dollar goes up, that's hard because typically you won't see ethanol demand increase. So if oil usage is down, that means ethanol usage is probably going to be down because they're directly linked to driving. And so if you see both of those take a hit on the demand side, that means we don't need as much corn to grind. So that's going to be something to watch going forward is oil prices. You know, when oil got up to $100 some, and all of a sudden ethanol margins started to improve, well, you started to see ethanol facilities start to grind more. So that'll be something to watch on the corn front.
So as we look, we got a new administration, it's going to be taken over here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
What's the grain industry what worries them, what excites them.
I think the big gorilla in the room, I mean, an elephant in the room is one thing, but a gorilla will go crazy, is a tit for tat tariff war again. That, and that's more on the bean front. But that, I think that's the biggest fear is, can we maintain demand in whatever kind of, playing field we try to get into in making ourselves, and the administration, it sounds like they're just trying to put us in a better position, of instead of always being the one just buying from somebody else, we're trying to get into where it's more of an even playing field. And I completely agree with that. But that's the biggest fear, is that if we start bucking the norm, what does that do to demand?
Do you think that could be a short-term pain, but a long-term gain?
So I think long-term gain, there's probably going to be people that disagree with me, is we just got to find other uses for this stuff. I mean, and we almost have to figure out how to use it independently. You know, I just said we use a lot of corn domestically, and that's great. And that's what kind of holds corn together sometimes, is whenever we have good domestic demand, it just holds there. It doesn't fall through the bottom, and we don't see $2 corn like we have in years past. So, you know, I think the long term is it's more of how do we figure out new uses for corn domestically, and I don't know what that looks like. I think beans have a bigger avenue for that than corn does. Corn seems stuck right now, in my opinion. So that's the tough part. Now, with Brazil going to China, whoever was buying Brazil corn, that's a new market for us. So we just, you know, we have to figure out these new trade partners. Just figure that it, all it is. I mean, you saw it in the Ukraine and Russia deal when the Black Sea got into it, and you've got Russia being what, the number one supplier of fertilizer to the market for certain things. You had to figure out trade flows.
That's right.
So now it's just going to be, how do we figure out the trade flow? And so I think that's just the biggest question is how does it all play out? Because right now it's just tough because the world has just produced itself into this predicament of, oh, we got plenty. So everybody's just like, we got it. We know it's out there. It's just,
we're kind of fickle when we talk about things because we don't want too much of a shortage. Right. That's bad.
Yeah.
That's not good. We don't want too much excess because that's not good. And it's hard to find the Goldilocks spot of supply and demand.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's where we've been the last couple years for corn. We've kind of been in this Goldilocks spot of where it's not like super, super tight, but it's not, we don't have a boatload of it out there. We've been, and luckily for us, we've been really spoiled. I mean, the last couple of years, and I know the argument of inputs were higher and fuel was higher, but typically you don't see record crops and historically high prices. And we saw that on corn, and we saw great production, great prices. You usually don't see that.
No, that's true.
So
as you look ahead, we've been talking about corn and stuff, but let's kind of bring the soybean market into it as well. You know, we've got, grain prices are down. Mm-hmm. Fertilizer inputs are up for some products. We look at the U.S. The prices in NOLA for fertilizer barges. You know, we're at a deficit to the rest of the world, so we're not attracting a lot of imports to bring that supply up and drive prices down. So it's going to be a challenge for the farmer as he goes out there and tries to make his buying decisions and what he's going to plant stuff. So what does the soybean market look like? If a guy says, hey, I need to plant some more beans this year, you know, what's your crystal ball tell us?
Boy, that's a big question. I don't know. I do know one thing, and I learned it in 2019. I will never doubt a farmer on what they want to plant. I'll never do it. At 2019, we had historically slow planting pace. And they got the acres that the USDA thought they were going to get, and they got even more in than what they thought. So never doubt them. I don't know. I don't know what the outlook. I guess if I take the information that I got from the November report, they lowered the yield 1.4 bushels. So we're still talking a good yield, 51.7, but it's not the 53.1. That was insane. So that dropped supply down 121 million bushels. What I didn't like was they messed with the demand side. And so that's where my crystal ball starts coming in. If I ever had one, it's more like a eight ball. I just shake. But imagine, I don't know. What is today going to be? Well, you're an idiot. That's what today's going to be. Perfect.
Try again.
Yeah. Looking for a sign, and the sign says suffer more. So, but they messed with usage. They dropped it down 41 million bushels. So net, you know, between those two, it comes out to 80 million bushel hit to the ending stocks, which is a good thing to see. You know, the hit on the yield was much more significant than the usage. So we're still talking ample supplies. I mean, this isn't a spot where it's like, oh my gosh, they lowered ending stocks, it should go up a dollar. And we haven't seen that. You know, we've been a week, almost 2 weeks post that report of doing this right now, and markets still keep bleeding. And it, as Americans, we like to say we're number one, right? We like that. We have the best, we have the best country. We have the most freedoms out of anywhere. And we do. We're not the number one player in the world for beans. We're just not. And we haven't been. So we almost have to re-rack our brain. I think that's something where we have to get out of the mindset of, well, we didn't have a good crop, prices should go up. The market really, I mean, it cares about the U.S., but not as much as it cares about South America bean production. And that is just the facts. So where we're sitting at crystal ball wise on beans, all eyes are on South America. Because if I look at the stocks to use rate, you know, we're at 10.8% as of the November report. Okay. So for perspective, that puts us in that 2017, 2018 type crop. Globally though, we're closer to the 18-19 spot. And that was not a good year. That was the very first fall that I bought and sold corn and beans. And that year we tried everything we could to not put a seven in front of the bean price. And that sucked. It was not fun. I mean, we had phenomenal production. We did, but it was just not fun. And at these types of prices with the inputs where they are, I don't know what the right answer is, because if you look at, you know, nationally, we did have great yields on corn and beans, but there's pockets out there that didn't. And I think that gets into some of the localized stuff. But if I still stay backed out, where is the big aha moment going to come from? And that's aviation fuel.
Yeah.
The problem right now is that they are allowing to get the, the tax credits. They're supposed to only allow verified used cooking oil. The problem is that it's not, some people are starting to point fingers and say, that's not really used cooking oil, verified cooking oil. So what we're finding out is what was going to be a huge market for the soybean oil, because it was going to be crushed here, we're going to use the meal and we're going to have all this oil, all these production facilities are going to come up and watch the beans. And I've said this, I think in the last year or two, like I love beans long-term, like in the years to come, I love beans because demand wise, we're going to all of a sudden, unless we can figure out how to crack the code on beans to get to 300 bushels an acre, we're going to be a net importer. And that's great. But we're not right now. And the problem is that the end users can import used cooking oil for cheaper than they can buy the soybean oil. Now, if some administrations figure out how to maybe put a lockdown on that and say, you know what, we're going to incentivize using domestic produced soybean oil versus imported used cooking oil, then you've got a market for this bean. I mean, you've really all of a sudden, you just gave it a testosterone shot in the arm and just said, go at it, guys. So that is something to watch going forward. If they can figure that out, if they can, I don't know what that looks like.
Because the used cooking oil is coming from China.
You want to see something scary is find out, is watch where they get that used oil from. And
and some of it's not even used.
I know.
That's, and it's so, yeah, I don't want to get into the political ring here, but They got to figure that out.
Again. Yeah. We don't get flagged again. Yeah.
They got to figure that out. So if they figure that out, it's great, great for beans. That'll definitely help us out in that situation. So well,
if we can fix that, if we can fix some of these, you know, conflicts around the world, you know, the wars in the Middle East and in the Ukraine, if we can fix those and increase that fertilizer production that's coming out of those areas and lower the cost combined with some of these things, then I think we're going somewhere.
Yeah. I think right now, you know, I get this and I'm not the most intelligent guy, but I get this question a lot of, well, input prices are high, so commodity prices ought to go up. Like, I think we're looking at this thing the wrong way. Commodity prices and maybe I'm not a fertilizer guy, but I think Josh Linville has kind of put some of these graphs together before. I know you and I have talked about it with StoneX. Commodity prices usually lead input prices because it's a supply and a demand. So if the demand, you know, we just talked about corn and beans. So if we don't plant as many acres, guess what? We don't need as much fertilizer. Okay. Or if we lower fertilizer rates, then we don't need as much. So then all of a sudden, well, what do you do if you have an ample supply of fertilizer? Well, you start dropping the price to get rid of it because you've got a bunch of it. That's what we're trying to do with corn and beans right now. We're trying to get the stuff out of here. We're trying to make it cheap to incentivize demand to get it moved. So if we can figure it out, then all of a sudden, you know, $9 beans or $10 beans looks a lot better if inputs come down a quarter of a, you know, 25% or whatever that looks like. That's arbitrary. I have no idea what they need to come down to, but if we can figure out those trade channels for fertilizer, then absolutely the input side comes down. And guess what? Corn at $4, what used to be the magic number was $4, all of a sudden starts making money again. And $4 right now does not make money. So we've just been in this transition period for a couple of years now where commodities went crazy. We had great production and demand was high, which led to the fertilized demand being phenomenal. And then we had the Black Sea and try to figure that out of, oh my gosh, how are we ever going to get any grain or commodities out of there? Well, we figured it out. It just changed.
Yeah.
But the fertilized piece hasn't quite gotten figured out yet. So we're seeing all these different geopolitical supply and demand, just all this stuff crammed into like a 3-year period. And everyone is just shell shocked. I think, I mean, it's just, what's the answer? I don't know.
Well, one thing about it is there is a new administration and that will be some change.
Absolutely.
We just don't know the tit for tat tariffs, like you mentioned. I mean, that is a scary thing. Mexico is our number one trade partner and that's a scary thing. I mean, so there's just a lot of things that'll be coming down the pipe that there'll be change. Mm-hmm. A lot of it'll be good. And hopefully there'll be some good stuff in there for ag too.
Yeah. Yeah. And as far as like what we're seeing locally, you know, we've spent this time talking about globally and nationally, like how does this look and all these big things. And we live in a global market. Let's face it. Local does certain things to fulfill their needs, but globally, that's what's driving the futures market. You know, Chicago Board of Trade global is what pushes that. It's not what happened in Davies County, Indiana. It's not. It's how did the U.S., how did South America, what does China's demand look like? What is Russia going to do? Are they going to nuke people? Are they not going to nuke people? What's going on there? That's what's driving the Chicago Board of Trade. Okay. What is driving basis? And so for our local listeners, what we saw this fall is the river was extremely aggressive and their traffic flow was half of what it normally is. And we've got some locations that, not Premier, but we've got some locations out there, end users, other commercial elevators. They finished harvest with a lot of space. Now, if you go further east into our territory, more towards the Brownstown, Columbus, and stuff like that, they seem to have held better. We saw on the western side of our territory, we didn't get some of the rains that the eastern part of our territory got, and we saw that reflected in the yields. And so for the first time in the last couple of years is, I guess I didn't need to sell that last 5,000 that I sold. Now, that last 5,000 that they sold sometimes was still at a higher price than what it is right now. So it was still a good sell. It's just that some of the bins aren't as full as we're used to seeing them. So, and we're seeing that reflected in the basis. And so I've came on here before and said, the job of the basis is to move bushels from where they are to where they are not. And if futures continue to take a hit, the job of the basis for the end user is it's going to try to pull it until it gets fed. So like your big ethanol facilities, your feed mills, any kind of end user in particular, even the export market, if they have sales on the books or they have a need for it, they're going to have to pay up to get it potentially if they don't naturally flow out. Now, the biggest question is with interest rate, you know, we've been talking about interest rates for the last several years, but now we've had several years of high inputs. Prices have started to come down on the commodity front. What are the money needs? And so do bushels just all of a sudden flow out and damage that basis that right now is historically high? So that's what we're seeing locally. Locally right now, the market feels like we don't have the bushels that the U.S. says we do, but that's a local dynamic going on. You know, we saw that down in, I think, North Carolina. They had some severe drought. I mean, some of that, I think some of the headlines that I saw was some of the corn, it's not even getting cut or harvested for corn production, like number two corn. It's just getting more for like silage and stuff because there was nothing there. So they were trying to turn it into something because they didn't have the yields.
Yeah.
So we're in a weird dynamic right now where we have ample supplies. And we've been very fortunate in our southern Indiana part where we've been with everybody else, where we've had great production. This year, there's going to be pockets where we didn't have that. And those are the ones that are going to have to, they're going to have to be extra diligent on how they market this old crop that they did put in bins. To just sit here and say, well, I didn't fill my bins, so farmer A, B, and D all the way through Z in Iowa didn't fill their bins, that's not accurate. We've got places that did fill their bins, plus some. So we have to look globally for the Chicago Board of Trade, locally for the basis. So that's how those two pieces play together.
Boy, you're right, Aaron, because sometimes we look out our window and we see what's happening right around us, and you know what we experience is what we think the whole market or the whole world is, and that is not the case. We're all guilty of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's human nature.
Yep.
Yeah. The market is an emotionless animal. I mean, it doesn't care how you feel, and we get caught up. I get caught up. I mean, everybody like you and Jeff and Sal have both said, we get caught up in projecting our own emotions, our own thoughts onto a free market that only cares about the numbers or geopolitical headline news. That's all it cares about. I mean, it's sad to say, but we can't put our own emotions on it. That's why we talk about targets. That's why we talk about having a strict plan, especially in these types of markets, having a plan set of saying, at this point, I'm going to let go of this. Put it in. Let's get it working, because we saw that 2 weeks ago. We had a couple of targets working. It ran up right out of the gate. We got it, smacked it. 5 minutes later, we were 10 cents away Wow. from that. We weren't even there anymore. But in that 10 minutes, we got it. And so that's the difference between a 425 and a 390.
And you have said it before, and the targets, they're available. You and Jason, I think you summed it up right there. And get a plan, get with your account manager on the input side, get with you and Jason on the grain side, and get a plan together for 25.
Yep.
Jeff, you got anything else?
No, I think that's a good one to end on right there.
I think so too.
Plan the work and work the plan.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron, always appreciate all your insight. You and Jason did an awesome job.
Well, we appreciate you guys having us on here.
All right. Well, that's another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.